50, out of 2.4 million, showed up. In Western Germany broadly, the new Allied currency, combined with price decontrols and other liberalizing reforms overseen by Bizonal Economics Director Ludwig Erhard, had an immediate regenerative effect on business. Almost overnight, hoarded goods in manufacturing plants began to move to the stores, Clay wrote to Burns. Even fruits and vegetables from the farm once more went on sale in the marketplace. Germany is going back to work. The people on the street visibly have taken a new hold on life. Yet at the time, the outlook was ominous. There were now two police forces in the city, two water and sewage systems, two gas and light systems, though those in the west operated only during daylight. Hilde Spiel could feel the change that had swept over Berlin since she arrived a few short weeks ago. Russian officials she knew well were now indifferent or hostile. Being no cold warrior herself, she was dismayed by the change. "Between us and the Russians," she lamented in her diary, "it is all over." The East Berlin Tägliche Rundschau newspaper announced that the Soviet military administration was now the only legitimate occupation authority in the city. Rumors spread rapidly, fueled by radio reports that the water supply was threatened by a power cutoff to the city sewage plants and that the Western powers were evacuating. As Clay and other Allied authorities tried to reassure Berliners, Reuter and fellow city leaders organized mass meetings, one bringing out over 80,000 to rally resistance, to call out the communists for using starvation as a weapon and to appeal to the Allies for protection and support. The Soviets, meanwhile, struggled to communicate one message to Germany and another about Germany to the nations they dominated in the East. In an effort to, on the one hand, undermine the so-called Marshall Plan, the Warsaw Declaration of the East Bloc foreign ministers condemned it for placing West German industry into the fetters of the American capitalist monopolies. One of the centerpieces of this policy, it said, was currency reform, the creation of a new West Mark, which by serving the interest of such monopolies created unemployment and misery. West Germany was being forced into enslavement, put to the service of the military strategic aims of Washington and London and the emerging Western Security Alliance. In an effort to, on the other hand, justify the Soviet Union's ever-expanding control in Eastern Europe, the declaration invoked the specter of German militarism, which the Anglo-American plan sought to revive and direct eastward. In the end, the Soviets failed to convince either Germans or their East European victims that they were defending them or their interests. Soviet and Western soldiers and police intermingled in Berlin in an atmosphere of crisis. When Sokolovsky's car was stopped for speeding in the Western zone, guns were drawn and angry words exchanged before the two sides backed down. The general returned to his headquarters without further incident, but a mistake on either side could have triggered a violent confrontation that would have been difficult to contain. An intense belated debate now raged within the Truman administration over Western vulnerability in Berlin. How far would the Soviets go? Would they starve Berliners? How would they react if ignored or resisted? Was the Allied presence in Berlin still tenable? What were the costs of withdrawing? "We are in Berlin by right," an emotional Kennan wrote to a friend, "and do not propose to be ridden out by any blackmail." The United States could not abandon Berlin, or the world would know well enough that we are turning 2,400,000 people over to all the rigors and terrors of totalitarian rule. Others in the administration, however, were unsure it could be avoided, the president included, though he was determined to try. For his part, Stalin was unwilling to part with Moscow's unassailable right under Potsdam, veto power over the political architecture of Germany, all of it. The most complete expression of America's aggressive interests is the incorporation of West Germany and the Ruhr into the Marshall Plan, wrote Foreign Ministry official D. Ignatieff. In order to preserve the military-industrial potential of the Ruhr and Western Germany as a whole, the Americans presented demands for the cessation of the dismantlement of German factories for reparations. This was in violation of all existing quatripartite arrangements of the occupying powers. The Marshall Plan, is aimed at the transformation of the Ruhr and the whole of West Germany into the main military-industrial base of American imperialism in Europe, and the transformation of marginalized countries in the areas dependent on this base. The Anglo-American economic policy in West Germany promotes German revisionist elements, which are campaigning against the Yalta and Potsdam decisions on the demilitarization of Germany and its obligations for damages caused by German aggression. If we were to lose Germany, Molotov told satellite foreign ministers at a gathering in Warsaw on June 24th, we would have lost the war. 2 weeks later, as British intelligence would discover, Moscow secretly informed the ministers of its intention to take control of all Berlin. The emerging showdown between Washington and Moscow, which would spread over the entire globe during the coming half-century, for now seemed oddly fixed on a single city in Central Europe. Berlin was a geopolitical black hole, one that was set to absorb ever more of the diplomatic energies of the two former war allies. By legend, the Berlin airlift was a bold and decisive response to defeat the blockade and prevent humanitarian disaster. Yet, as a strategy, it was neither bold nor decisive. It was neither intended to beat the blockade nor to feed Berliners indefinitely. No one in the Truman administration believed at the time that an airlift was more than a short-term expedient to keep options open. Defeating the blockade, it seemed certain, would require a military challenge. As for humanitarian concerns, these were raised primarily by those who believed the Allies needed to withdraw from the city. Moscow would then bring in supplies to curb unrest. Anticipating escalation after the Soviets shut down interzonal travel, the U.S. Army had begun to position supplies for an air ferry on June 18th, a week before the full blockade began. The first C-47 flights flew in 5.9 tons of supplies to Tempelhof Airfield on June 21st. British Dakotas landed their first 6.5 tons at Gatow Airfield on the 24th. Soon, massively laden planes would be rumbling over the city's tattered roofs in quick succession, landing as often as one every 3 minutes. The Allies also began hitting back with a counter-blockade, halting shipments and traffic by rail and barge from Western Germany into the eastern part. Allied officials wryly blamed technical difficulties of their own. Sokolovsky was, according to American intelligence reports, greatly shocked to discover how dependent the East was on coal, steel, machine tools, and industrial commodities from the West. On July 3rd, the military governors reassembled in Berlin for a last effort to defuse the crisis on the ground. The atmosphere was heated. "How long do you plan to keep it up?" Clay demanded of Sokolovsky. "Until you stop your plans for a West German government," he replied. Truman had at first downplayed the crisis, referring to it as the German currency squabble with Russia. But Sokolovsky's response made clear that the B-mark issue was secondary. As with the Marshall Plan, Stalin's real concern was the political and military agenda that lay behind American economic interventions. Forever traumatized by the Nazi invasion in 1941, he was determined never again to leave his country vulnerable to German military capacity and intentions. The timing was, however, also inauspicious for compromise. Only a few days earlier, Stalin had expelled Tito's Yugoslavia from the Cominform. This was a new factor of profound significance that has been introduced into the world communist movement by the demonstration that the Kremlin can be successfully defied by one of its own minions, Kenyon observed. By this act, the aura of mystical omnipotence and infallibility which has surrounded the Kremlin power has been broken. The possibility of defection from Moscow, heretofore unthinkable, will from now on be present in one form or another. With dangerous division within his own ranks, Stalin could ill afford to show weakness over Germany. As for Truman, he told his staff that there was nothing to negotiate. Russia has never kept any of the agreements she has made. Yet for all his legendary toughness, he was unwilling to confront Stalin at this stage. He pledged only to stay as long as we could without armed conflict. Nothing in the history of air logistics, North Europe's weather, or Soviet behavior suggested that anything more was a responsible objective. An incident with Soviet personnel hampering Western traffic could escalate into war. He feared an accidental conflict more than a deliberate one, with a trigger-happy Russian pilot or hot-headed communist tank commander setting off a spiral of deadly response and counter-response. An airlift, however, was obviously no solution, Boland said. Clay initially saw it provisioning his garrisons only. It could not possibly, he told Pentagon officials, belying his earlier bluster, supply the German civilian population with adequate coal and food. Bevan took it as given that it would not be possible to feed 2 million Germans by air. He hoped only that a big display of strength and determination would boost German morale. Such humanitarian action in the face of ruthless Soviet policy of starving the Germans for political advantage, he believed, would show the Russians up in world opinion. Reuter agreed that Berliners would rally behind a show of will, but stressed that the city had barely a month's supply of food left. It needed 1,300 tons a day, plus another 2,000 tons of coal, which required a much larger air operation. In Washington, the consensus was that the Allies had a 2-month window to resolve the standoff. Ganeval thought the situation would be absolutely hopeless by the end of July. The Soviets would then have a knife at our throat, Army Chief of Staff Omar Bradley agreed. We must decide now whether we are willing to fight. Preparing to settle in for a diplomatic struggle, Truman was anxious to document the sources of Allied legal rights in the city. Yet the mass of diplomatic files assembled since Yalta offered the most meager basis for such rights. Ambassador Murphy blamed a defective wartime agreement with the Soviets, motivated by a naive American outburst of faith and goodwill. Faced now with the possibility of war if Truman were too aggressive, and a calamitous loss of credibility if he were too weak, impassioned advisers urged the president to move decisively in different directions. Clay led the hawkish wing. I'm convinced, he cabled the army in Washington, that a determined movement of armed convoys would reach Berlin and would prevent rather than build up Soviet pressures which could lead to war. The Russians, he argued, did not want war. Intelligence reports indicated no abnormal troop movements, stockpiling activities, or other military preparations. They would, therefore, not likely interfere. The blockade was intended to drive out the B-mark and halt the creation of a West German government, not to starve the population. The latter would, in Murphy's words, only undermine Soviet political aims in Germany. Nevertheless, Clay conceded, I realize fully the inherent dangers in this proposal, since once committed, we could not withdraw. An armed convoy was a sound strategy if the Soviets were bluffing, but Clay was not consistently of that view. He had in fact told the French and British that war over Berlin was inevitable within 18 months. If this were so, a convoy was reckless. There were only 6,500 Western troops in Berlin compared with 318,000 Soviet ones in Berlin and the surrounding Eastern Zone. Lieutenant General Curtis LeMay, commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe, thought Soviet forces could overrun West Berlin in 8 hours. Bevan and Robertson shared Clay's assessment that the Soviets were bluffing, but thought the convoy scheme flawed. Robertson pointed out that the Soviets could simply stretch tanks out across the Autobahn to block it. This would oblige Allied forces to shoot their way through, triggering escalation or retreat. Lovett argued that the Soviets would just cut bridges in front of and behind the convoys, stranding them by blocking their advance and retreat. Royal led the dovish wing. He demanded that Clay shut his mouth after being quoted in the New York Times saying that Moscow could not drive us out by any action short of war. What was at stake, Royal told him, was a minor issue, Berlin's currency. In sharp contrast to Clay, who later reflected that there would likely have been no Marshall Plan or NATO if the United States had abandoned Berlin, Royal believed that the United States need not, and indeed could not, remain in the city. Clay was, he felt, exaggerating the costs of withdrawal to U.S. prestige and influence while underestimating Soviet readiness to use force. The Joint Chiefs concluded that the entry of armed American forces into the Russian zone would in fact be an aggressive act. It was therefore too risky. Some army officials argued that withdrawal would be necessary to avoid a civilian catastrophe. The only question was how to avoid the appearance of a rout. U.S. forces were facing a defeat if the war comes, Leahy said. Yet a retreat, Murphy insisted, would amount to a public confession of weakness under pressure. It would be the Munich of 1948. He would 16 years later say he should have resigned in public protest against Washington's feeble policy. Reliance exclusively upon the airlift was a surrender of our hard-won rights in Berlin, a surrender which has plagued us ever since. Douglas argued that withdrawal would probably cause failure of the European recovery program, if not a complete collapse of confidence in American resolve on the part of West Germans and the people of Western Europe generally. Marshall wanted to take the issue to the United Nations, but the French pushed back, fearing it would accomplish nothing except provide Truman with a moral basis for war, the effects of which they would bear. The compromise was a simultaneous written protest delivered to the Soviet embassies in the three Western capitals on July 6th. The Soviet reply came back 8 days later. Once again, Moscow blasted Washington and London for violating the commitments at Yalta and Potsdam to pacify Germany and to extract reparations for its victims. The Allies were now using currency reform and dismemberment, creation of a West German state, to undermine Soviet rights in the country. Berlin, Moscow said, was part of the Soviet zone, and the economic threat to the zone from the B-marks circulation necessitated the protective measures the Western powers were now protesting. The interests of the Berlin population do not permit the introduction of new currency in the Western zones of Germany and special currency in the Western sectors of Berlin. Furthermore, it said, the West's removal of the industrialized Ruhr from four-power control undermined the demilitarization and democratization of the country. By ignoring their obligations in Germany under earlier agreements, the Western powers had forfeited their right to participation in the administration of Berlin. Moscow therefore not only rejected a lifting of the measures for the restriction of transport communications between Berlin and the Western zones as a precondition for discussions over Berlin, but insisted that any talks on the city be conducted within the four-power framework. This demand was code for rolling back currency reform and plans for a West German state. Finally, Moscow said it was willing and able to provide adequate supplies for the entire population of Greater Berlin on its own. West Berlin's suffering was the fault of the Allies. Their withdrawal was the surest means of alleviating it. In the wake of Moscow's defiant response, Marshall told the cabinet confidently that the tension in Berlin owed to Russian desperation in the face of success of the ERP. The West was winning, and Clay was as upbeat as ever. The very violence of the Soviet reaction now, he cabled Army Undersecretary Draper, is the proof of the success of our several programs to restore democracy in Europe. His stance is stunning for an American military governor who, until the spring of 1947, had tended to ascribe breakdowns in U.S.-Soviet cooperation not to the triumph of democracy, but to failures of unilateralism in Paris and Foggy Bottom, the State Department's new home. Clay continued to press for ground confrontation, proposing that Brigadier General Arthur Trudeau lead an armored convoy of Allied troops through the Soviet zone and into Berlin. LeMay would then bomb every airfield in East Germany if Trudeau met resistance, which he did not expect. Sokolovsky's troops, however, had been conditioned to believe they were defending sacred Soviet borders and would almost certainly have resisted the invaders. Yet when this possibility was put to Clay, he responded by asserting the futility of concessions. The Russians, if they were bent on war, would just pocket them. Nothing, it seemed, could dissuade Clay. Both a weak and a bellicose Russia were reasons for confronting it. Bideau condemned his bluster. The British chiefs of staffs rejected his scheme under any conditions. Truman was morose. The Soviet response, he reckoned, had been a total rejection of everything we had asked for. At Bevin's urging, he authorized sending 60 B-29 bombers to Britain, together with a public announcement from the Pentagon. B-29s had bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and he wanted Stalin to take note. "Our only advantage," noted British Air Commodore William Arthur Darvill Brooke, "is our possession of WMD. Still, Brooke wanted this only as a bluff, which it was. These particular B-29s could not carry atomic bombs, though Stalin should not have known this fact. That is, he would not have known it except for the fact that Donald MacLean, his supermole in Washington, told him. Continuing to take an upbeat tone with the press, Truman lamented to his sister that the situation was all so futile. Every major poll suggested he was headed for defeat in the November election, and, "If I win, I'll probably have a Russian war on my hands." A top-secret Soviet intelligence report in June 1948, possibly written by MacLean, suggested the Kremlin was anxious to gauge how far Washington would go to defend its stake in Berlin. Despite French concerns that the U.S. position seemed dangerous and irresponsible, the report, clearly translated from a foreign source, said the U.S. military would resort to force if the Russians at any time make it impossible for Americans to stay in Berlin. Molotov, who annotated it, would have noted its observation that Truman had not decided when and under what circumstances force would be employed, if it would be employed at all, to subvert non-military Soviet measures. There was thus scope for ratcheting up pressure on the city, short of downing Allied planes. Determined to escalate the matter to the UN if diplomacy failed, Marshall was willing first to try engaging Stalin directly through an oral approach to Molotov. Bevin thought an oral approach weak, but Marshall insisted it was the only way to break the logjam. Written communications simply hardened Russian intransigence over wording. As usual, the American prevailed. The Allied governments requested a combined ambassadorial-level meeting with Stalin and Molotov on July 30th to discuss Berlin and its wider implications. Molotov agreed only to meet them serially, hoping, in Smith's estimation, to maneuver one or the other into revealing the price the West would pay to end the crisis. In his exchange with Smith, he continued to insist that the Allies could not hope for change in Berlin without engaging on Germany as a whole. But he agreed to forward the request for a meeting up to Stalin. Stalin, thinking the endgame he had envisioned in the spring had begun, invited the Western emissaries to talks on August 2nd. Smith was accompanied by French Ambassador Yves Chataignol and British Minister Frank Roberts. At 9 that night, early by the Generalissimo standards, Stalin greeted them in his office, highlighting the unusual nature of the audience he had granted. With three Allied representatives present, he set forth his position. Western rights in Berlin, he said, derived from the city's status as the capital of a unified Germany. Now, with the Allies setting up their own West German state, those rights no longer had a juridical basis. This stance was a dramatic hardening of the Soviet diplomatic line, denial of all Western occupation rights in the city. There would have been no restrictions in Berlin, he told them pointedly, had it not been for the London decisions to divide Germany. The restrictive measures adopted by the Soviet authorities had been to prevent the invasion of the Soviet zone by the special Western currency. Smith replied that his government would do nothing to prevent the formation of a central German government in the future, should the differences between the two sides be breached. But the United States would not negotiate under duress. As for the currency matter, he proposed that the Allies might withdraw the B mark from Berlin and begin talks on Germany if the Soviets would lift the blockade. But Stalin returned again and again to the London program. "Stop applying the London decisions and withdraw the B mark," he said. "Then there will be no difficulties. It could be done tomorrow. Think about it." Smith said he would report Stalin's position to his government, but felt that the implementation of the London decisions had reached a point at which it would be extremely difficult to hold it up. Around 11 p.m., Stalin proposed resuming talks in the morning, but Smith insisted there was no point. Progress had been quite inadequate. Stalin must have known, given McLean's intimate knowledge of Allied deliberations in Washington, that the West put little stock in the airlift beyond September. Time was on his side. He therefore needed to string the Americans along to keep them hoping and talking. Stalin lit a cigarette, smiling. "Would you like to settle the matter tonight?" "Yes," Smith assured him. "He would like nothing better." Stalin made a new proposal. The B-mark and the blockade could be removed simultaneously. As for the London program, it could be recorded that its postponement was the Soviet Union's insistent wish. Smith was taken aback. Was this a climb down? He could see no diplomatic meaning in an insistent wish. It gave the Allies full freedom of maneuver. He would even suggest that Marshall unilaterally suspend parts of the London program to retain negotiating chits for the future. The three emissaries agreed to present the proposal to their governments. Both sides now believed the other was anxious for agreement and looking only to save face. But neither was reading the other accurately. Stalin was ready to roll back the blockade, partially, but not as a prelude to restoring Western powers in the city. He intended to use the Soviet mark to push the Allies out. For its part, the State Department was ready to abandon the B mark, but would accept nothing less than a full managing stake in a unified currency regime for the city. There was still no locus of interests. On the ground in Berlin, Clay was horrified that Smith did not see the trap that was being set for him. Having through early 1947 condemned anything that interfered with efforts to bring the Soviets into a partnership for unified German government, Clay now argued against efforts that interfered with progress towards splitting Germany. Back in July 30th, the Soviets had begun using their control over the city's central bank to freeze the accounts of the Magistrat and all Western sector enterprises. They were asphyxiating the economy of West Berlin and the powers of the non-communist government. Municipal officials knew that, with Soviet control over Berlin's money, it was only a matter of time before Moscow and their SED puppets controlled the whole city. Berlin political leaders are frightfully upset at the rumor of Soviet currency becoming the single currency in the city, Clay cabled Draper on August 7th. If we are voided of all control, they will be at the mercy of the Soviet government. But Marshall was not as naive as Clay feared. With the B-mark gone, he told Smith, four power control of the city's currency would be essential and non-negotiable. Whitehall understood the same. On August 6th, the Allies presented Molotov with a draft communique calling for all restrictions on transport communications into and out of Berlin to be lifted, specifying conditions under which the Soviet mark would circulate in the city, and stating that four power talks would aim to resolve wider issues related to Germany. Molotov immediately opened vigorous attack on Western demands to control the currency of the Soviet zone, of which Berlin's economy was an integral part. He further protested that there was nothing in the draft about the insistent desire of Generalissimo Stalin for the postponement of the London decisions. Smith called Molotov's response the typical Soviet tactic of trying to sell the same horse twice. Still, he assured Marshall, there was no reason to be either depressed or encouraged. The next meeting, he insisted, will be more significant. To Bohlen, who had been certain Stalin's insistent wish was a ploy to prevent creation of West Germany or pin the Berlin crisis on the Allies, Smith's take must have appeared as dangerous wishful thinking, born of a reluctance to admit he had been snookered. The British were alarmed. Roberts judged that the Soviets were not optimistic about killing the London program, but thought they were in a strong position to expel the Allies from Berlin, a good consolation prize. The city's currency, Bevan said, was now at the heart of our difference with the Russians. Robertson agreed, concluding that if we withdraw our currency without any agreement on quadripartite control, we shall have lost Berlin and the airlift will have been in vain. On August 9th, Molotov presented the Allies with his own draft, which seemed to confirm British suspicions. Clay condemned it as disastrous and unthinkable. Blockade restrictions imposed prior to June 18th, the date of the Western currency reform, would stay in place, implying that they were defensive in nature and legitimate. Western access rights would not extend beyond those accorded through the present agreement, which were nil, in that none were enumerated. Molotov rejected four-power control of Berlin's currency. Power was to lie entirely with the Soviet-established Bank of Emission. A Soviet agency would assume control over the city's exports. This new authority, he argued, was consistent with the Allies having illegally ended quadripartite control over Germany. Finally, Stalin's insistent wish was to be clarified. A statement would be issued that the Allies did not propose for the time being to deal with the question of the formation of a government for Western Germany. This clarification meant that dealing with it would signify a change in the Western position, giving Moscow a pretext for retaliation. On the ground in Berlin, Soviet officials turned up the pressure. They harassed the Magistrat and nullified its powers in the east. Thousands of SED supporters staged violent demonstrations throughout the summer, disrupting the assembly. Soviet soldiers ran down an American MP in the Western sector before shooting their way out. Rioters beat up reporters from radio in the American sector. The CIA concluded that, under present conditions, the Western position in the city was untenable in the long run. Further meetings between Smith and Molotov on August 12th and 16th yielded no movement. "All very hard going," Smith said, belying his earlier prediction. Molotov now appeared to be in no hurry about a settlement, possibly because of the anticipated effect of winter on our airlift, or hoped for deterioration of economic conditions of the Western sectors. His attitude being quiet and reasonably pleasant, the purpose seemed to be to keep talks going almost indefinitely, to prevent us from adopting an alternative course of action. Matters, he told Marshall, were no longer by any means hopeful. At a National Security Council meeting on August 19th, with Truman presiding, Marshall and Lovett said the Soviets were using power over the city's currency to expand a physical blockade into an economic and financial one. The CIA pondered Stalin's intentions, weighing the costs of compromise against the benefits of ending the dilemma in Berlin. Marshall concluded that there is nothing to be gained and much to be lost by any further attempt to negotiate with Molotov. He decided to make a final appeal to Stalin before escalating to the United Nations, a move supported by Clay, but still opposed by Schumann, who saw it as a prelude to war. But both sides were feeling time pressure, raising hopes that a deal could still be done. Marshall was concerned about signs of public restlessness, given that mere technicalities seemed to be preventing agreement. For his part, Stalin was focused on the September 1st start date for the West German Parliamentary Council, staffed by 64 elected representatives under the CDU's Konrad Adenauer as president, to begin drafting a constitution in Bonn. This was his last chance to stop it. Stalin granted a meeting on the evening of August 23rd, greeting the Western emissaries quite jovially. Posing once again as the fount of affable reason, he offered broad-brush concessions on the blockade and the currency. He agreed in principle to remove all recently imposed communications restrictions on Berlin, no longer just those imposed since June 18th. He further agreed that the Four-Power Financial Commission would be the controlling body for the currency operations of the Soviet Bank. It looked like a deal. Almost. Stalin continued to insist that something must be said about the London conference. He wanted no further movement toward a West German government before a new meeting of the four-power foreign ministers. He preferred a published statement to this effect, but was willing to consider an exchange of confidential letters. After 2 hours with Stalin, the emissaries spent three more working with Molotov as a drafting committee. Other than the ongoing matter of Stalin's insistent wish, which the three agreed only to pass on to their governments, things went so smoothly, Smith told Marshall, that I was a little worried. I remember Stalin's proverb, "An amiable bear is more dangerous than a hostile one." There was still inordinate detail being left to the military governors in Berlin to resolve. Would they be able to agree to a plan for simultaneous removal of the blockade and consolidation of the currency on a week's deadline? It was an impossible job, Smith feared, but I don't see how we can spare more time. Marshall and Clay expressed alarm that Molotov had refused, for reasons related to the Soviet juridical position, to affirm quadripartite control over Berlin in the draft directive. With what appeared to be a scolding from the secretary, Smith's frustration boiled over. "Quadripartite control does not exist in Berlin today," he cabled back, "and the Russians have no intention of permitting its revival so long as they are unable to achieve quadripartite control of Germany." Marshall, he believed, needed to accept reality and make up his mind. "Either we simply stay in Berlin under present conditions and take the necessary measures to organize the life of the three Western sectors independently, or we accept the blockade's lifting under circumstances in which we would not have complete control over the life of our sectors." Trying to have an independent West Germany and a four-power Berlin was, to his mind, denying reality. He recommended that the Allies seek concessions from Molotov with no expectation of success, and then pass on the directive as is to the military governors to see if they could make it conform to Washington's demands. If they failed, Washington could then walk away. Ominously, Molotov refused to allow any of his or Stalin's oral assurances into the directive, insisting he would not be drawn into discussing a new document. He asked repeatedly, however, that Soviet wording on the London decisions, which the Allies had rejected and would not agree to in a form acceptable to Moscow, be included in an immediate communique. The reason for the hard line seemed clear. By the time the directive was ready to be issued to the military governors on August 30th, the Bonn Constitutional Convention was 2 days away. Stalin was about to lose a critical leverage point, and with it, reason to follow through on concessions. But Stalin had been prepared for this eventuality. He had told Tito Deputy Gielis back in February that "the West will make Western Germany their own, and we shall turn Eastern Germany into our own state." The objective was now to secure Berlin as East Germany's undivided capital. When the military governors gathered at 5 p.m. on August 31st, it was the first time they had met in nearly 2 months. Sokolovsky's demeanor, a concerned Murphy recorded, was mildly provocative. He seemed imperious, wanting to show his mastery of the situation. It was not an air he would put on without orders from the top. "I have never felt so discouraged and hopeless," Clay wrote in anticipation of the encounter and the likely fallout. "Hold on tightly to, and do not make any concessions away from, the decisions agreed upon in Moscow." Molotov had ordered Sokolovsky by top-secret cable earlier that day. "Keep in mind that the Western representatives are particularly striving toward a widening of the authority of the Financial Commission. This cannot be allowed." Sokolovsky disavowed knowledge of oral understandings reached with Stalin and Molotov in Moscow. No communications restrictions introduced before June 18th, he said, could be lifted. And new ones would now be imposed on air traffic into Berlin, limiting it to support of the occupation forces. Unregulated flights, he explained, undermined operation of the Soviet mark, the city's sole authorized currency. As for the Soviet bank, he insisted the four-power Financial Commission could have no powers over its operation. Once the Allies withdrew the B-mark, the financial life of the city would pass to Soviet control. The following week he announced that Soviet aerial military exercises would begin in the corridors over Berlin. With the airlift now under direct military threat, a furious Clay cabled Draper in Washington on September 3rd, insisting to know the endgame of U.S. policy. Was the United States determined to remain an occupying power in Berlin? Agreeing to any of Moscow's terms, he was sure, was inconsistent with such an objective. Since the president was still groping for options short of war or withdrawal, Royal could only assure Clay that the administration would not sacrifice its rights for an end to the blockade. "I am sorry," Murphy cabled Marshall on September 7th, the deadline for the governors to complete an agreement, "but we are getting nowhere. The Soviet attitude is indifferent almost to the point of being contemptuous. They are making only those proposals which would give them complete control, so as to make our acceptance impossible." The governors adjourned without agreement on a joint report, or even agreement on a report of their disagreements. But there were new problems, Murphy explained. Soviet tactics in Berlin were getting rough. On September 6, the 1,500-strong communist mob blocked the city assembly from meeting. Three American reporters were beaten up. Under orders from a Soviet officer, uniformed police from the eastern sector arrested dozens of plainclothes officers from the western sector brought in by the deputy mayor to keep order. Murphy feared they were led off to death or worse. Over 300,000 Berliners rallied on September 9th in the city's Platz der Republik near the Brandenburg Gate to hear Reuter and other city leaders condemn the Soviet blockade. "We cannot be bartered. We cannot be negotiated. We cannot be sold," Reuter shouted. "We will stand together until this fight has been won." Riots broke out when East Berlin police beat back demonstrators passing through the gate. A Soviet war memorial flag was burned and police cars overturned. 12 days later, CDU interim mayor Ferdinand Friedensberg would meet with Major Boris Ochkin, the Soviet chief of the Department of Civil Administration, within the city's four-power occupation authority, the Kommandantura, using remarkably bold language to criticize the policies and behavior of the Soviet occupiers. "The fundamental relationship of the German population to Soviet power has been deteriorating. A balancing of the tensions that have now assumed global political extent can only be achieved by improving the immediate relations of the German population to the Soviet occupation. The Soviet occupation forces have committed two fundamental errors. The first is that the use of government and administrative forms that have proven themselves in the Soviet Union is in no way possible in the same manner towards the German population. Germans aspire to make their political life according to their own democratic forms and to establish good relations with the Soviet Union in accordance with those forms. However, these efforts stand against the policy of the Soviet military administration, which holds fast to the imposition of other political forms and restricts the area of German self-government. The second is that the Soviet occupying power relies on the communists, to whom they give all possible support. But the communists constitute a small minority, and will also be a small minority in the future, having been rejected by the vast majority of the German people. The intransigence of the Soviet occupying forces has led the German people to a rigid and often imprudent behavior towards them. I deeply regret that after 3.5 years of Soviet occupation, the German and Soviet people have failed to achieve mutual understanding. Privately, the city leaders also criticized Western diplomacy for being weak. They struggled to rebuff rumors in the city that the Allies would withdraw the B-mark as a prelude to withdrawing troops. These rumors were undermining the currency's value. Sokolovsky's position, Marshall concluded, and with even greater force, the Soviet-inspired disorders designed to overthrow the city government elected under quadripartite supervision make it plain that the Soviet government seeks to nullify our rights in Berlin. Truman assembled his top military brass on September 13th to review options, including nuclear strikes. In Moscow the following day, the Allied emissaries made a final request for a meeting with the Soviet leader. They were told Stalin was on vacation. Molotov received them 4 days later, but dismissed their complaints that Sokolovsky had not followed the directive. "It was they who had distorted it," he said, "by demanding financial commission powers over the whole activity of the German bank and repudiating an earlier 1945 Air Corridor Accord. The directive being ambiguous on the Commission's powers, the Allies had depended on a measure of Soviet goodwill in hewing to Stalin's oral assurances. Soviet literature, however, had extolled the use of currency manipulation during the Russian Revolution, and Douglas, for one, was not surprised that Stalin wanted to retain that weapon in Berlin. His backtracking on currency cooperation, together with new air traffic restrictions, convinced Marshall the Soviets were yet again negotiating in bad faith. Looking back on events months hence, Foy Kohler, the American chargé in Moscow, would conclude that the Kremlin had fashioned the impasse to spin out negotiations indefinitely, maintaining the blockade meanwhile. Indeed, Stalin had shifted his chips. Having failed to stop the Bonn Constitutional Convention, he was now betting the house on the airlift collapsing by winter, and with it the morale of West Berliners. The airlift had been more successful than we had anticipated, Marshall told the NSC, yet he warned that in many respects time was still on the side of the Soviets. British tonnage had topped out at 1,463 in August and would fall to 1,259 in September and 1,030 in October, as mechanical and logistical problems emerged. But on the American side, even Marshall could not yet see that the Allies were on the verge of a breakthrough. It began quietly in late July, with the appointment of a new airlift commander in the Wiesbaden headquarters. Major General William Tunner was not your typical air commander. He did not share his colleagues' fixation on bombing. A devotee of Frederick Taylor's theories of scientific management, Tunner took an odd interest in the ability of planes to move people and equipment long distances at great speed. He brought in motion study engineers to analyze the airlift in theory and practice, and ordered what seemed to all involved baffling changes in practice and procedure. They paid off. Average daily deliveries rose from 2,226 tons in July to just over 3,800 in August, within reach of Clay's target of 4,500. That month the French also added a new airport in their zone at Tegel. By September, the airlift was shuttling in a record 4,593 tons daily, just above Clay's target, though below the 6,000 tons Friedensberg thought necessary. Clay was now arguing that he could best the blockade indefinitely if he could just get some more planes. 116 more, to be precise. In Washington, however, it seemed a dangerous gamble to commit more resources. Half the available military air fleet was already devoted to the Berlin mission. Shifting more would degrade the strike force the United States might need to deter or repel a Soviet attack. Politically, Marshall was being squeezed. To his right, the Joint Chiefs were critical of efforts to contain Russia with relief supplies and diplomacy. To his left, the president was frustrated by failure to nail down what seemed a done deal just a few weeks earlier. Stung by cries of warmonger from the Wallace camp, Truman began maneuvering behind Marshall's back to cut a deal with the Soviet leader. At the urging of political advisers who point to rising numbers of voters fearing the possibility of war, Truman decided to send a personal envoy to Moscow to meet with Stalin. This would demonstrate to Americans his commitment to securing peace. Eisenhower, like Marshall, a war hero, was the most prominent name in the mix. But Truman wanted someone he knew, someone who knew him and could speak for him, someone not like Ike. He insisted on his longtime poker partner and former Treasury Secretary Fred Vinson. Now Supreme Court Chief Justice, Vinson had no special knowledge to bring to bear on Berlin, nor experience in Soviet affairs. But Truman hoped he might break down barriers with Stalin, letting him unburden himself to someone on our side he felt he could trust. The two sides might then get somewhere. That a president who prided himself on standing up to the Russian menace should believe that such a complex, dangerous conflict could be treated as a personal misunderstanding reflected in equal measures, desperation, and ignorance of how the Soviet system worked. He had been unchastened by Stalin publishing Smith's private remarks in May. Truman referred to old Joe as a decent fellow, one who is being misled by Molotov and pushed about as a prisoner of the Politburo. Yet even if it had been true, the idea that it could be overcome by a heart-to-heart with a hard-boiled Kentucky politico seemed far-fetched. Vinson himself was astonished at the request and agreed only with reluctance. On October 4th, Truman finalized the draft of a public address explaining the gravity of the conflict with Russia and his decision to send an envoy to Moscow. Vinson's assignment would not be to negotiate with respect to the Berlin crisis, but to discuss the moral relationship between the two countries. Premier Stalin, he wrote, had assured him of his desire to talk with Justice Vinson. Truman also implied that the Secretary of State had approved the mission. Marshall knew nothing about it. Lovett was beside himself. He warned the president that his boss, then huddling on the crisis with Bevin and Schumann in Paris, would resign. Truman agreed only to postpone a decision until he returned. Marshall was now as bullish on Germany and the airlift as he had ever been, and therefore determined to take a firm line with Stalin. A presidential emissary with no knowledge of the recent months of grueling diplomacy was not what he had in mind. "We are on the road to victory," he told Bevin and Schumann. "We have put Western Germany on its feet." As for Berlin, "The air ferry counteracts the blockade very well. It can take care of the needs of the Western sectors for as long as we wish. It is not even that expensive." So when Lovett broke news of the Vinson mission to him on October 5th, he was apoplectic. "This was," Marshall said, "an initiative unique in the history of diplomatic bungling." But before he could get home to deal with Truman, the story had leaked and broken in the Chicago Tribune. Now having to confront the fallout, Truman regretted the whole idea and was determined to put things right with Marshall. "I won't do it," he told his advisers, even as they insisted that the Vinson mission was still his best chance to stay in office. When Marshall arrived on October 9th, the two concocted a story that they had discussed having Vinson carry a message to Stalin regarding the atomic problem and the president's desire to see peace firmly established in the world. But in the end, the statement explained, Truman decided not to take this step owing to the possibilities of misunderstanding. Though the mission was now scotched, Marshall thought his efforts in Paris badly undermined. Indeed, Bevin and Schumann were now less sure than ever whether Truman wanted to start a war, abandon them to one, or both. On October 14th, State Department Kremlinologist Foy Kohler cabled Marshall from Paris. Stalin, he said, had concluded that there was now no chance of preventing the creation of a West German state by negotiation, even at the price of concessions with respect to Berlin. The only way he saw to bring about the destruction of the London decisions and disrupt the unity of Western powers was therefore to undermine their governments. His new strategy was to use communist-directed disturbances in France to hasten the advent of de Gaulle, who was himself bitterly opposed to those decisions. Loyal and discreet, Marshall may or may not have used the word resign, but in poor health, he made clear to Truman that he would not remain in his post beyond Inauguration Day. Expecting Dewey to win the election in any case, he even suggested to John Foster Dulles that, owing to the emergency character of the world situation, he should replace him immediately following the election. A stunned Dulles reminded Marshall that Truman would still be in office another 3 months, and that even lame ducks choose their own secretaries of state. The creation of the United Nations was meant to be Roosevelt's crowning contribution to the post-war order. It would, he believed, prevent an American retreat into isolationism and turn the Soviets from confrontation to cooperation. Instead, Marshall was now determined to use it to isolate Moscow on the world stage. In October, he took the blockade to the Security Council under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which covered threats to peace. He set the United States up as prosecutor, targeting its case to the six neutrals, Argentina, Belgium, Canada, China, Colombia, and Syria. Bevin and Schumann signed on only after putting up spirited resistance. The sole purpose they could discern in involving the UN was to secure moral sanction to break the blockade with arms, and it was their nations that would bear the brunt of the Soviet response. The Russians, Bevin groused privately, had played their cards very badly. But this had forced us into a closer association with the Americans in Germany than we had wished. Truman, however, who had only just abandoned a peace mission, had made no decision to use force. Some in the administration, like Royal, were still pushing for a face-saving withdrawal from Berlin. Draper called the city an untenable military outpost. Backtracking from his earlier hard line, Kennan, too, was now concerned over the Allies' increasingly unfavorable position. He opposed using the UN to isolate the Soviets. Rather than mobilize the smaller nations, he said, it would likely alarm and paralyze them, undermining their will to play an active part in the organization. As for the Russians, if cornered, they will just leave the organization. Smith, believing the crisis to be a self-inflicted wound, argued that any UN action that enables us to get out of Berlin would be very desirable. For their part, the Soviets were thrown off guard by the UN gambit. To that point, they had had little experience manipulating the Security Council. On September 25th, Vyshinsky, in a 6,000-word speech before the General Assembly, denounced the Western powers and the instigators of a new war. In a show of sheer comedic paranoia, he backed up his claims of American warmongering by referring to a map allegedly showing the Third World War Pacific Theater of Military Operations. The map had been forwarded to him in July by Colonel General Fyodor Kuznetsov, head of the main intelligence agency, GRU, of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, who said that it had been created by the American oil company Esso and received from our source in Tokyo. The map was in fact titled Esso War Map 3, featuring the Pacific Theater. It was produced during World War II as a customer marketing giveaway. Conscious of the West's built-in voting advantage and recognizing a show trial when he saw one, Stalin rejected UN jurisdiction on the Berlin question. He ordered Vyshinsky to invoke Article 107 of its charter, which said that nothing in the present charter shall invalidate or preclude action in relation to any state which, during the Second World War, has been an enemy of any signatory to the present charter, taken or authorized as a result of that war by the governments having responsibility for such action. On this basis, Vyshinsky insisted that German policy could only be discussed within the Council of Foreign Ministers. By refusing to participate in Security Council debate, however, he gave the three permanent Western members free rein to denounce Soviet behavior unrebutted. The result was predictable. On October 5th, only Soviet Ukraine joined Vyshinsky in voting against UN jurisdiction. The following week, Vyshinsky tried to quash the intervention through the Security Council's Argentine president, Juan Atilio Bramuglia. The Peronist is critical of the capitalist system, Vyshinsky noted approvingly in his diary. He said it had outlived its day. Fawning and apologetic in their secret meetings, Bramuglia had, Vyshinsky told Molotov, tried to avoid presidency of the council, and with it responsibility for the Berlin question, but did not succeed. On October 11th, Bramuglia briefed Vyshinsky, warning him that they were speaking in the strictest privacy. Having conferred with the Allies, he said, the neutrals believed they could take Berlin off the Security Council agenda if the Soviets agreed to a simultaneous lifting of both sides' trade and transport restrictions. The Council of Foreign Ministers could then reconvene to resolve remaining issues related to Berlin and Germany as a whole. Vyshinsky demurred, demanding that the Allies also complete removal of the B mark at the same time the restrictions were lifted. Bermuda warned that the Allies would insist on an end to the blockade before the currency transition was complete, not after. If the Soviets wanted their version, what could they offer in exchange? Nothing, Vyshinsky said. The best option was to drop the point. Bramuglia responded that the Allied position was actually closer to the August 30th directive, to which Vyshinsky replied that it could in that case form the basis of the CFM discussion. This proposal served Molotov's aim of elevating the directive, or the Soviet interpretation of it, into a legally binding commitment. Bramuglia liked the idea. Vyshinsky promised an official response within a few days. After securing approval from Molotov and Stalin, Vyshinsky affirmed his stance, reminding Bramuglia that the Berlin question was not, in any case, subject to discussion in the Security Council. It should be removed. Bramuglia returned for clarification the next day. Were the Soviets saying the August directive should regulate matters until the CFM could meet? This was, he said, how the other neutrals understood it. No, Vyshinsky said. It must govern within the CFM. I thought this was the case, the Argentine responded dejectedly, knowing the Allies would reject it. Bramulia, Vyshinsky cabled Molotov on October 15th, expressed regret that he ever fell into this story,